Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Kyle and Patrick's yet-to-be-named podcast. This time, Kyle's not here, so it's just me, Patrick McEwen, and I am joined by a special guest this time, Dylan Ward, world champion with the Canadian team in 2014, all-world goalie, the World Championship MVP from 2014, current goalie for the Colorado Mammoth in the NLL, with the Atlanta Blaze in the MLL, and was an All-American at Bellarmine. Welcome to the podcast, Dylan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And so the topic that we want to mostly be talking about is the U19 World Championships. They just wrapped up the preliminary games, the last of the Blue Division preliminary games last night, and the quarterfinal and placement games are going on today, but the big ones are happening tomorrow night, and I guess mostly what we're going to be focusing on is the U.S., Canada, and the Iroquois. So I wanted to start by recap for people who maybe haven't been paying that close of attention what happened in some of the preliminary games, the important ones. And so in the opener, the United States beat Canada 12-5, and it was pretty much in control from start to finish in that one. Want to share some of your thoughts on that game, Dylan?
Sorry, that was the Canada game?
When the U.S. beat Canada in the opener.
That game, you could tell U.S. was just a well-oiled machine. They're very well coached. They have incredible athletes, and they definitely took advantage of a Team Canada team who I don't think yet has an identity, and is still kind of looking for answers in terms of their lineup and who their pairings are going to be in the midfield and attack. So, I thought the U.S. came out, played extremely well, extremely disciplined, and really took it to a Canadian team who, like I said, is still, I think, working on their on what they want to be.
Okay, I guess I had a little different take. My thought, because I think we've kind of seen the U.S. play the Canadian team, or in parts of it, twice. We saw them in January in the, I forget what they called it, but it's like the spring premiere of the U.S. national teams. And then we saw during the tryout process, they kind of had a scrimmage against the Hill Academy, who had at least a couple of the pieces who are in this game right now. And the big thing to me, I thought the U.S. defenders did a much, much better job handling Jeff Teat, and to a lesser extent, Ethan Walker, and kind of that the lefty two-man game on the wing there, I think, is Canada's, on their offense, their primary mode of attack. And that really is sort of the identity of the team to me, is those two guys initiating, picking and rolling there on the wing. And I thought Jack Rowlett and some of the U.S. defenders did a much, much better job than they had previously against that.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. That first game, Jeff Teat was virtually invisible, and that Canadian team is definitely going to rely on him to put the ball in the back of the net, or at least draw enough attention where he can move the ball and get other guys open looks. But like you said, the U.S. team, their defense is very athletic. They're very strong, and they're a disciplined team. And you can see it's a very similar defense that I was familiar seeing when I was in college playing against Ohio State. So. I completely agree. I think they did a great job on limiting Jeff Teat and Ethan Walker's spacing and their flow.
And the other thing, I guess, I thought, my other observation was on offense, there were a couple of really uncharacteristic bad passes or drop on the banana bounce, turnover, just unforced errors that I don't know if you can attribute it. I think the obvious thing that people try to say is it's nerves, but I'm skeptical that those guys were nervous in that game. But in the first quarter especially, I thought they kind of took them a little bit to settle down on offense.
Right.
And that really hurt them.
I don't know if it would be nerves or the fact that, they're playing on the world stage. It's not an exhibition anymore. These games actually do matter. And, they're playing in Canada in front of a strong Canadian contingent. So, I don't know, maybe nerves may have had a bit to do with that, but I think it's just the flow of the game, and these guys are still trying to. Matt Brown has a very sophisticated offensive system that he likes to run, and not everyone. I'm sure not everyone was 100% comfortable with it yet, and you could tell they were kind of just rolling their midfield lines too. So even guys, it was tough for guys to even just get consistent reps, and start to feel that flow of the game. So, you know, I'm sure down the stretch they'll be shortening the bench a little bit more in these next few games.
No, that's true. And I mean, it's the first game. It's a, especially with all those games, so many games in so few days, it's sort of, it's a marathon, not a sprint. You don't want to wear your guys out in the first game when they got to go play, you know, four or five more games in the next 5 or 6 days.
Yeah, of course.
Though speaking of some of those guys, another guy that I thought stood out to me just watching the Canadian team, in addition to Jeff Teague, has been, I think Trey LeClaire is a phenomenal midfielder.
Yeah, he is great. I mean, he's just, you know, he's the kind of the midfielder that you're not used to seeing in Canada that often. You know, he's got a great downhill presence, and he can still play that sweeping offense that Matt Brown likes to use. But he's such a versatile player, and he can really bring it on when he gets time and space. He can shoot on the run, and he's a great passer too. So I think he's been Canada's best player so far in this tournament.
Oh, and I think he's definitely up there in the conversation. I mean, Anasio, I think, has been very good as well, facing off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
In that discussion. And that's something that the U.S. team has kind of figured out differently than previously. In the first game, and then that Hill Academy game, I think he was something like 20, 22 of 32 or some. He's like 65, 70% in there, and that really hurt the U.S.
Right, especially in this game where possessions are so valuable.
Oh yeah, especially with the U.S. basically deciding to hold for one anytime there's under about a minute and 30 left on the clock at the end of the quarter. They're really, really milking the clock down and limiting the number of possessions.
Of course.
Kind of moving on, the next game, sort of sequentially between sort of the big three, was the Canadians beating the Iroquois 12-9. I think it was, Monday night?
Yep.
Or Sunday?
Sunday night, I believe.
Yeah, and that was a game that was, I want to say it was tied. I think Nanticoke had the buzzer beater at the end of the third quarter to make it 8-8 at the end of the quarter, and after three, and then the Canadians outscored them 4-1 in the fourth quarter to take the game. And that was definitely was a very close game. It was a phenomenal game to watch from both sides offensively. So many great plays. Do you have any thoughts on that game?
I thought that was an awesome game. You know, there was like until the end, I don't think there was a lead bigger than one goal. It was just a back and forth game. You know, obviously Austin Statts and Tohogan Nanticoke were phenomenal for the Iroquois team, and they just create so much space for the rest of their offense. But you know, it was just a prototypical Canada Iroquois game. Like, guys are very familiar with each other on each side of the ball or on each team, and you know that they know each other's tendencies, and it's just a battle every time. I feel like every time Canada and the Iroquois play, and this game was no different.
Yeah, no, definitely it was. I think it was by far, from what I've watched, it was the most entertaining game of the tournament. It was up there as, you know, one of the best games I think in lacrosse of the year so far. It's definitely on that, or definitely merits consideration.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. And, it was, like I said, it was back and forth. It was just, it really was a slugfest. You know, the goalie play on both sides was pretty strong. The defenses were doing what they could against two very strong offenses. And I thought they played admirably. And then, you know, the offenses were just, they were clicking. You could see they were comfortable with each other. They knew what the coaches wanted of them. And they just played out of the sets that they were given. And I think Tohogan Nanticoke and Austin Statts are incredible talents, and you know they're gonna be phenomenal, I think, in the college game. Obviously, Austin's gonna be playing at Onondaga next year, and
which just isn't fair, really.
Right, it's gonna be something else for him there. But you know, I think those two, you know, are just supreme athletes, they're supreme lacrosse players, and you know, like I said, it was a slugfest. It was very fan friendly, and you know, it even had a little bit of drama there with the two field changes.
I'm glad I stayed up to watch the end though, but that was like an hour, ended up being like an hour delay as they had to move around, and was not a great situation, but
definitely not.
Made it a memorable game.
Yeah.
And then the third game, I guess, was the U.S. kind of stomping the Iroquois. It'd be 17. They got up to a 3-0. The Iroquois got up to a 3-1 lead on three Austin Statts goals, and then the U.S. scored 16 straight to kind of run away with it. Wasn't there wasn't that much, I feel like, to discuss from the game. So I wanted to kind of turn it a little bit to, I feel like when I watch international play, that the, with these three, it's really the U.S., Canada, and the Iroquois in the field are the top three in 2014 in the indoor.
Right.
But there's stylistically and kind of in the nature of the way their teams are built, it makes sense to contrast the U.S. with the Iroquois and the Canadians, given sort of the box and field backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And so just wondering, curious, from your perspective, what's the biggest difference when you go as playing for Canada to playing against the U.S. versus playing against the Iroquois?
I think it's just, the Iroquois is very, very free flowing. You know, they have their basic sets they want to be in, but it's free flowing. They just kind of like are very creative. That's a better word. But, you know, if you can shut down the two Tohoga and Austin, I think their offense is very, very one-dimensional kind of. I just don't think they have the depth that the Canada and the U.S. have, whereas the U.S. is just such an athletic beast. They can possess the ball for so long. They have incredible athletes who most of their team already has a year of college under their belt, so they've been training in college weight rooms for a year. So, you know, it's just two different animals. You have the very creative Iroquois team, and then you have the very structured and athletic U.S. team. So, you know, I think it's two completely different playing styles.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Is there any? Yes, you've obviously never been on this side of things, but what do you think the differences are between the Canadians and the Iroquois from the U.S. perspective as the U.S. team is sort of preparing to play each of those teams?
Canada and the Iroquois obviously have a very big box influence on their styles. You know, we don't have those big north-south Dodgers. We don't have the Kyle Harrisons who are going to absolutely toast a guy one-on-one down the alley and hit a 10-yard shot on the run. But so it's a much more methodical game, I believe, with Canada and Iroquois. They're looking to draw and dump rather than, you know, run by you. So I think it at times can be a slower paced game, but at times, like we see with the Iroquois, it can be very fast, like three or four passes and the ball's in the back of your net, rather than, you know, banging around, get set into your sets, whether you're playing a 1-4-1, 2-2-2, whatever set they're in. And it's you can see that box influence where, you know, they're not as hesitant to jam the ball into the middle or make that skip pass or passes that you don't see as often in the U.S. game. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something you're talking about. That's the biggest difference I see, is that in sort of the decision making, the Iroquois, I don't want to say they're I don't know if what's the best way to phrase it. They're not as risk averse as the Canadians.
Right.
I feel like they retain more sort of their box instincts with the 30-second clock.
Yeah.
And they don't hesitate to jam it inside. Whereas I think the Canadians in the indoor game are just as likely to jam it inside.
Yep.
But in the field game, when they play the field game, they do a better job of adapting to the more conservative style that you need to be successful in the field game.
Yeah, I agree. I think they do. I think, like I said, I think that the Canadian offense is a little bit more methodical. You know, the Iroquois, I don't want to say they play with like a reckless abandon, but they just, you know, they're just always on. They're always looking. If they see a stick, they're going to hit it. So, or they're going to try and hit it. So, you know, I think, like you said, Canada, I agree with that. They have their box instincts, but at the same time, I think they have a little bit more patience. And, you know, if that pass inside isn't there, they don't have a problem banging around the outside again.
Yeah, and that's always been sort of the genius of Matt Brown. Mm-hmm. That people talk about him from an X's and O's perspective and the intricacies of the offense. But when I sort of break it down, I guess a lot of there's not the sort of strategic X's and O's elements that they do are not necessarily that unique or any different from what other people are doing. They do them very, very well, and in some cases they're better at the window dressing and disguising them. But fundamentally, I think his genius to me is taking box players who are used to that very free-flowing, high risk, high reward, up and down, you know, risky style from the box game, and getting them to play a much more conservative, risk-adverse style in the field game to avoid turnovers and avoid taking bad risks while still being able to utilize some of that box magic to score goals.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's no secret that they like to play the two-man game and push it back or push it inside, but if it's not there, they have no problem, you know, banging around, setting up again, and going right back at it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and especially I think one of the things I think he does better than anybody is they use the two-man game as what I would call, like, window dressing.
Right, yep.
That they run dummy two-man games that aren't, they're not, that's not trying to score, because it draws two defenders over to a part of the field because you're scared of it,
yeah.
And they bang it somewhere else to attack from there while they have two defenders drawn out into a corner somewhere.
Exactly, yeah. He is one of a kind in terms of coaching the offense. And, you know, even with the Worlds, when I was on the defensive end, I got a little taste of it, seeing what his coaching style and the way, like, he really is just a player's coach. He's so good at understanding what he has and then working an offense around what he has to work with. It's incredible.
Oh yeah. And I think I just wanted to the point you made earlier about Trey LeClair that I think you're absolutely right. That the way you describe it, that he's a downhill, he's sort of an American style midfielder,
right,
on the Canadian team, that he brings that element that you don't always see with Canadians, of sort of a Kyle Harrison, you know, Paul Rabil type downhill dodging midfielder who can just run by people one-on-one and score.
Yeah, exactly. And that's very, very nice to see. And, you know, it just adds another element to that Canadian team.
Yeah. And I think that was, to me, that was sort of a big difference for them against the Iroquois, is having that element to go to,
mm-hmm.
where the Iroquois, with they have Stotts and Nanticoke kind of leaning in, running two-man games, pick and pop, you know, trying to muscle underneath guys around GLE. And the Canadians have those type of guys, and they also have sort of that midfield threat.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely a great different look for them to have, so that they're not just stuck with they don't just rely on just one different look, one look all the time. And, you know, another guy, Trey LeClair, I don't think he hasn't been putting up the kind of points that Trey LeClair has put up, but Wagner is an incredible athlete too. I don't think he's as polished as him, but he's kind of like that more north-south athletic player as well.
Yeah, I guess I can't say I've paid too much attention to him, but I'll trust you on that.
I think he's been more of a two-way guy too. He doesn't have any points right now, but just watching in the US game at least, I just noticed how athletic that he really was, and you know, his game really impressed me. But you know, I think he's just another guy like Trey LeClair who just gives them a different look on the offensive end, whether he's playing offense or defense.
Yeah. Kind of looking forward, so the way it's set up, the Iroquois are going to play. They play Ireland, the Iroquois play Ireland today, mm-hmm. and then the winner of that game plays Canada tomorrow, I believe is the mm-hmm. schedule. And so, for our purposes, that Iroquois Ireland game actually it might be going on right now, if it's or it's on very soon as we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. We're just going to assume that the Iroquois beat Ireland, because that would be, as far as I'm concerned, a massive upset,
right?
And talk sort of to preview the likely Canada Iroquois rematch in the semifinals. And so, do you have any thoughts on what for either team? What do they need to do or improve upon or do differently from their previous game?
I think I think it's going to be a slugfest again. I think Canada and Iroquois, like I said, they're very familiar with each other, and I think they're just going to beat the crap out of each other. And you know, I think if Canada wants to be successful in the defensive end, I think they need to make Austin Stotts and to Hogan and Coke passers. I think, you know, because they're incredible dodgers, and, you know, I think they're both shoot first kind of players. So I think they need to make them make decisions early rather than letting them try to bully their way to the net to be successful. And then I think, you know, I think the Iroquois defense really needs to get some stops. I think that's a bit of the weakness for them, is that their defense as a whole. So if they can really, you know, get on the same page defensively and force the Canadians to make more as many passes as they can, rather than just letting them play their offense and be comfortable in their offense and have their goalie make a couple stops, I think that's what they're going to need to be successful.
No, I would definitely agree. But to me, and I thought this was the turning point in the fourth quarter of that previous game, I thought it was the faceoff battle. And that relates a lot to what you were saying about the Iroquois defense getting stops, that I thought through the first three quarters, the faceoffs were relatively even. It was something like 50-50. And right. The game was tied. And then Anacio just went on like a five, maybe it was the end of the third quarter into the fourth, but he won like four out of five or something like that, and gave the Canadians, they had, I think, two or three make-it-take-it possessions.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, face-offs in this game are so huge just because of the way the rules are. You're not guaranteed to get the ball back. So, you know, face-offs are definitely going to be a huge play. And it's so crazy to me that Doug Jamieson for Iroquois is a face-off guy, just because, you know, he's a huge guy, and he's a box goalie. He's an incredible box goalie, but... You know, to see him be as successful as he is, minus that U.S. game at the faceoff dot, has been pretty cool to see for me. But yeah, those guys, that's going to be a huge part of this game, because first off, if Canada can have possession, you know, that just keeps the ball out of Nanticoke and Stats sticks, and you know, if they don't have the ball, they can't score. So the faceoff X is going to be a huge part of that game.
Yeah, and it's something that you kind of can look at. The importance of the faceoffs, to me, is always sort of determined by the ability of the offenses relative to the defenses.
Right.
And in games where the offenses are better than the defenses, that means more of the possessions will be determined by faceoffs.
Yeah.
And that definitely, I think, applies to both of these teams, where offense is their strength rather than defense.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So that's sort of important. And then... Australia and Israel are going to play today, and I think Australia is probably the favorite in that game. Though, I guess an Israel upset isn't totally out of the question. I think it'd be a surprise, but then whoever wins that game, I think, is going to lose to the U.S., and that would be a stunning, you know, upset for the ages type win if either of those squads were to beat the U.S. to go to the gold medal game. So we're going to kind of get ahead of ourselves, and sort of talk preview the U.S. against the Canada Iroquois winner.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you have any thoughts on, if you're the U.S., who do you want to see in that gold medal game between the two? Who are you rooting for, the Canadians or the Iroquois?
Well, I think, you know, just based on pool play, I think you want to see the Iroquois just because of what they were able to do against them. But at the same time, you know, I think the gold medal game is going to be much closer than what we saw in either of the pool play games. So, you know, I think the U.S. right now kind of just has to focus on themselves and what they need to do to be successful, rather than, you know, focusing on who they may or may not play in the gold medal game.
Oh yeah, that's true. But that's the fun part. You're kind of new to this, to the media side of things, as opposed to being a player. But that's the fun part about being in the media is that
to do this kind of thing, right?
Right. Yeah. If you're a player, you're absolutely 100% right. If you're playing or coaching, you definitely don't want to look ahead. Well, less so if you're coaching. You kind of need to do some preparation ahead. But you want to keep the team focused on the next game, and, you know, get them fired up to go beat, you know, Australia to make it to that game.
For the fun of it, I think if Iroquois can make it to that gold medal game and Nanticoke and Stats can get hot and they can, you know, win some faceoffs at the X that they weren't able to do in the round robin game, I think they are a very, very scary team on paper. But, you know, I think that rivalry with Canada has just been so – it's been so deep. I know U.S. has absolutely dominated this U19 tournament since its inception. But, you know, I think that rivalry between the U.S. and Canada is just it'll make that gold medal game an absolute war. So, you know, I think that they would rather see Iroquois rather than than Canada.
Okay, I agree. I think from a winning standpoint, I think you'd definitely rather see the Iroquois.
Yeah.
That I think part of I want to get into this a little bit later, but talking about we talk about sort of the box game relative to the field game. But I think the U.S. the big advantage of the U.S. is athleticism, and I think that is it's much more apparent against the Iroquois than it is against Canada.
No, I definitely agree on that. I don't think the Iroquois defense is as strong as Canada's, and you know, I think like you said, they're much more athletic, and I think that they have the ability to play their north south dodging game much easier against that Iroquois defense.
Right, exactly, and I think from a face off perspective, there's no question that I would rather Doug Jamieson has been pretty good, and I would handicap, if I'm handicapping the faceoff, I would have him as the fourth best guy in the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Anasio is a guy who's going to set foot at Ohio State and immediately be a very good top 20 type faceoff guy in Division I.
Which is great to hear for Canada lacrosse.
I would not at all be surprised if he. I don't know if he'll be the guy or if. But he'll definitely. I think he's definitely in the discussion for the men's team in 2018.
I think he'd have to be, but you know, if Jeff Schneider thinks he's still got another tournament in him, which I wouldn't be surprised either. I think Inacio has a very good chance of being the next up and coming faceoff guy in Canada. I mean, Jake Withers at Ohio State right now as well has been very very strong, but you know, it's. It's nice to see, especially from a position where we've relied on one guy for so long at the men's level.
No, I think both of them, they're interesting guys. They're different stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's the kind of thing, I don't know if you want to waste, it's just not to say waste, but to devote two roster spots to the guy. But those are the two guys I guess have an eye on. I don't know. Maybe I'm just missing somebody, is it Inacio or Inacio?
I wish I had the answer for you. I think it is Inacio, but I'm not positive on that.
Jake Elliott says Inacio, but yeah. I had thought, and I've met him, and talked about him a couple times with some of the Faceoff Academy guys. I mean, he was the runner up at the Faceoff Academy National Showcase, and I came away from that thinking Inacio. So.
I wish I had the answer for you. I really don't. I know when I was talking to Brody Merrill about him the other day, he was saying Inacio too, so.
Oh, okay. Then maybe. I mean, he coached him at the Hill Academy, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So, okay, maybe it is Inacio. Apologies for mispronouncing that if that's the case. But anyways, yeah, I mean, that he's a guy who wants to win control of the ball, that he's going to try to clamp and take control of it. Whereas Jake Withers is a guy who is one of the better sort of counter quick rate guys.
And he's also, Withers is a great lacrosse player as well. You know, he's not your typical, prototypical Fogo. Like he can, you know, I actually played against him last night in a senior A game back up in Canada. You know, he's a strong defender, and he's capable with the ball very, very much so.
I mean, I think both of them, I guess I can't say for sure that I've ever seen them, either of them play, but I always, watching him just pick up the ball, I always get the impression that Inacio is a solid player as well.
Agreed. I just don't have, I haven't played against him personally. I'm just going off of, personally playing against Jake Withers multiple times.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But the biggest, when you talk to guys who have faced off, the tricky part is Withers. Is you can't. He's very difficult to read on when he's going to quick rake and when he's going to clamp.
Yeah,
and he has gone his freshman year when he was the guy, he was very much just a quick rake every time, or not every time, but most of the time. Mm-hmm. In this past year as a junior, he, I would say, was somewhere 50-50 between quick raking it and sort of standing up and just trying to winning the ground ball and clamping it and winning control. So I think it'd be nice to have both of those guys on the roster, just because if you run into whoever, the American guy who's just rolling, to be able to, if Inacio can't beat him, to be able to throw Withers out there as the counter guy.
Agreed. And I mean, you look at the MLL, and you know, obviously Greg Granlund has been a little beat up this year, but you see teams throw two guys at him in games, and you know, they want those high scoring games, and you can see he just get. You can wear guys out when there are those 30-40 face-offs in a game when you've only got one face-off guy. So, you know, I think there's definitely advantages for having two face-off guys on your roster, especially if you have the intentions to shortening your bench anyways.
Yeah, absolutely. Though it's, I mean, you're talking far fewer face-offs in an FIL, a world championship type game. But what did I say? But my thought on the U.S. team, I feel like there's this sort of the X factor in terms of who you want. I think on one hand, yeah, you're a much better chance against the Iroquois.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like there's, given what happened in the last two world sets of world championships, the U19 women's last summer and the men's in 2014, I feel like there's some gold medal game revenge that needs to be exacted against you guys.
Did it not? So I believe the last, like, since 2006, every, like, 2006 men's, the winner between Canada and the U.S. in the round robin game lost a gold medal game. 2010, the winner in the round robin lost a gold medal game. 2014.
2012 and U19, it happened as well.
Yeah, exactly. And in 2012, it happened as well. So it's a pretty scary trend that's going on right now. If I'm a U.S. fan, but you know, I don't know how that keeps happening, but it's a pretty interesting storyline to look at moving into these medal round games.
Yeah, and I actually didn't go back that far. That's one of the things I did want to ask you about, because it happened with the U19 women's in 2015, last summer,
yeah,
where the U.S. won the first game,
yep,
and then the Canadians won the gold medal game.
Yeah,
venture to throw out a theory, do you have any thoughts on what it might be?
You know, I think, I don't know if I have a strong theory, but, you know, I think I feel like whoever's winning that first game is because they generally play, like, pretty early in the tournament, and you know, you saw with the U.S. at the World Championships last time around, like they walked through the tournament, like they didn't even sneeze at a team. It was a cakewalk through for them through the round robin, and you know, they really didn't get tested. Whereas, you know, Canada, we got beat up pretty good by the U.S. in the first game. We had a one goal game with Iroquois a couple games later. Like, it's just, you know, I think the team who loses that game is a little bit more battle tested. You know what I mean? Whereas, you know, the team who wins that can almost fall into a little bit of a trance or be a little bit more complacent because they haven't had to deal with adversity like the team who loses that first game of the tournament.
So you're thinking, is it a case where when you lose that game, you then know what sort of adjustments you have to make and what areas you need to work on? And so then you get more out of those blowout games, even if you are still winning them by as much, but you know in your head what you need to work on and what needs to get better.
Right. Like, you use those games as a building block almost. Like, you see what MIDI lines work together, like what different lines look to work together well, and you know, you just get to use those as I don't want to say practices, because that's almost insulting, but you know, it's just, you know, what you have to build off. You know what didn't work in that first game, and you know, you just get to use those games to try things out and see what works successfully to build into those medal round games.
Right, I guess, but a lot of that happens even if you win that game, though, you still get to use those games to get better and build.
This
question is, there, I guess, does losing reveal something about you? that you need to work on to then make better use of those games?
I think it might. Like I said, I don't think I had a very strong theory, but you know, I think getting taking that loss, you know, like you said, you just kind of know where you're struggling or what didn't work, so you can use the rest of the tournament to make the changes you need that you think will be successful.
Okay, and then especially since you've watched the Canadian team most closely, what, assuming if it ends up being the U.S. and Canada again, what does Canada need to do differently this time around against the U.S. to beat them?
You know, I think defensively they just need to throw different looks at the U.S. They can't let them be comfortable in their offense. You know, I think they need to throw a couple different packages at them, whether they're turning their Dodgers into feeders, or you know, throwing a zone look at them, or not sliding at all to guys and making them beat you one on one. I think they just can't let the U.S. get comfortable in their offensive sets. And then obviously in the offensive end, they need Brownie is going to be putting together some sort of game plan, and they just need to stay true to that. They need to listen to Brownie and what he has to say, and just, you know, stick to the process on offense. You know the turnovers are going to happen. Their defense is so strong and athletic that, you know, it's going to happen. But they just need to stay true to what Brownie is telling them, and you know, not try and go on their own and be a lone wolf.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I think to me, I looked at it and kind of talked about this earlier, that it's the key is really it's the offensive end.
Right.
That Canadian teams in general, I feel like in the field game, are driven more by offense rather than defense. And given the number of possessions, I don't want to say 12 goals, allowing 12 goals to the U.S. was good, but I'm not sure there were any terrible defensive breakdowns that I think if you end up playing make it take it a couple more times helps reduce the number of possessions your defense has to face and brings down that number of goals a couple times.
Right.
And so watching that game, the Jeff Teat running that two-man game still scares me to death.
Yeah, he's one of the best in the game right now on that low wing. It's incredible what he can do from that spot. So if he can, you know, if he can start to beat or win not a one-on-one matchup, but if he can start to draw enough attention where he's able to get those guys open looks or other guys open looks, it could be a long day for that U.S. defense if they're unable to make those adjustments.
Yeah, and I thought there a couple of times they were real close. Just watching it, there's a couple like, oh no, he's about to do something.
Yeah.
And score.
Yeah.
And I'm not even necessarily sure that there has to be a major adjustment, that I think just get a little bit of luck getting those looks to fall. Because they were, especially in the first half, something was clearly off. Whether it was they were, you know, a couple of those offensive players woke up, didn't sleep well the night before or something, you know, which wasn't their best game. So I'm not even necessarily sure there has to be any major adjustments. I think if they just can cash in on a couple more of those looks, if the bounces that weren't going their way the first time start going their way.
Yeah, you got to give credit to the U.S. goalie. He played very strong in that opening game. He made a lot of, you know, big saves on some open looks. So, you know, if they get a couple more of those to drop and the Canada gets a couple more stops in the defensive end, that game had the potential to be a little bit closer. But you know, I think you're right. I just don't think Canada had it that night.
Oh yeah, I mean it's the face-off battle we talked a bunch about.
Oh yeah,
about Anaccio. But I mean he's very good, and he went 50% against both of the Americans in the first game, and I don't know how. I think it's tough to say if that was a good game or a bad game for him, but it's very possible that was just sort of a typical game, and with a little bit of luck, he could end up, you know, 60%. And I think that would do wonders as well, that if the offense starts cashing it in, you can play make it take it a couple times. That's really where Canada has a chance to excel.
I agree. And then again, like we said, if the U.S. is covering that two-man game with Teat on that wing, they have Trey Leclerc that, you know, can kind of take the U.S. out of their defense, or if they can try and spread them almost away from that and try to get that two-man game going off of a dodge one side and then bang it over to the other side, and they can spread the D a little bit. I think, you know, Trey Leclerc could be a big impact in this game.
Oh yeah, and I think that's what I would look for Matt Brown to do, is to utilize the lefty two, because Trey Leclerc is a righty, right?
I believe so, yeah.
That utilize him, his one-on-one dodging threat, either as the attack or as the window dressing, combined with that lefty two-man game, and try to disguise which one they're actually running, and then attack with the other, and make the Americans try to defend both simultaneously, which is probably impossible to do.
No, I agree. I think if they can get Trey Leclerc to be a big, I almost put him as an X factor for this game.
Yeah, because I mean, on the left wing, there's a couple. Ethan Walker is sort of, I would say, 1B to Jeff Teat's 1A as a lefty attackman down there.
I completely agree. He's going to be a special. Brownie's got to be very excited to have him walking on campus next year.
So I think there are multiple guys that they can utilize in that role. And Riley Curtis.
Yep.
Yeah, is another one who was. They have a couple different guys they can run if somebody's having an off night, but I don't think they really have. There's not necessarily a great second option to Trey Leclerc.
Right. Right.
Kind of switching gears a little bit. One of the other big things that I wanted to talk about with you was, and we touched on it a little bit in some of our discussions, but was kind of the box versus the field game.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hear a ton about people discussing the advantages coming to the field game from the box game. But I kind of want to go the other way and ask what are the disadvantages of coming up playing box and then shifting over to the field game?
Wow, that's a question I've really never been asked before.
Because it just seems to me, if there are advantages,
there has to be advantages, right? Yeah.
Because it's different. It's almost like there's no free lunch. It's very rare that you get like a sort of a free lunch, so to speak, and it's just better in every single possible category. Regard.
Well, I think the one thing is that, you know, we definitely don't have the downhill dodgers that the U.S. have. we only have Trey Leclerc is the only one on that Canada team. We don't have an offhand. Everyone is very one hand dominant.
But I guess
I don't know if that is a disadvantage. I think it could be used as a disadvantage, especially for guys who are very ambidextrous or have two very strong hands. But I'm going to put it as a disadvantage just for the sake of the argument.
Okay.
Again, I think we have, Canada has a lack of ex attackmen. We don't have players who are very, very good at blowing by a defender at ex, creating a slide to find an open guy. So I think our ex game, our ex attackmen are a little bit lacking compared to the U.S. We don't really have those bangers like a Joey Sankey or, you know, I guess like
Rob Pinnell. Rob Pinnell, exactly. Is the perfect. Rob and Jordan Wolfe are the
or even two. Even a Steele Stanwyck. He might not be much of a banger, but he's an incredible feeder from that X position, both righty and lefty.
Yeah, absolutely. And Wells as well.
Wells, yeah. I mean, look at the 2014 World Game. We had Jeremy Noble, who played D midi to O midi, and then was an ex attackman for us at the World Championships. So, you know, we really don't. That's just one. I think one position where we're kind of, I don't want to say lacking, but we don't have the same kind of ex attackman that they do in the U.S.
Oh yeah, I mean that's an obvious one. That's a disadvantage of the box game, because there's no area behind the net, so exactly. you can't get used to playing back there.
Yeah, and our field, like our field in Ontario, growing up, our field season was 4 weeks long before we had the. you know, these club tournament teams that we'd play on. Like we would play 10 games over 4 weekends and then have a provincial championship, and then that was it for field lacrosse for the year.
Yeah. Want to get back to though, you mentioned the downhill athletes, the downhill dodging midfielders.
Right.
And so I have thought about, that's one of the things I had thought about. And I guess my question is it a case where just the smaller population size of Canada means you don't have the pool of athletes to pull from? And so the athletes aren't there to sort of compete with the U.S. in that regard? Or is it that for whatever, the box game somehow doesn't develop those players, and so you have those athletes, they're just not, end up don't being good lacrosse players because of the box game?
I think you go both ways on that. I think, you know, population could definitely be a factor, but at the same time, I think that we train a little bit differently up here. Like, we really, I don't, like, you know, it's tough to say because you see a little bit more and more at the younger ages of these downhill dodging a little bit more. But, you know, I think they don't, we're just not, guys aren't being trained to be speed, like burners. They're not trained to be downhill dodgers, just blow by guys left and right. It's more like quick twitch, you know, play the two-man games, play very much on the wings rather than up top. So I think it could be a little bit of, you know, the box game is played on the sides. You know, you have your, it's very much, you know, you're left-handed, you play on the right side with your stick to the inside. You're left-handed or right-handed, you play on the left side with your stick to the inside. So I think that's a big factor to it. And I just don't think we train the same as the U.S. in terms of being these just freak north-south running athletes.
And then so my other thought, and it's something we talked about with both Canadians and the Iroquois teams, was that I think you end up, and it's not that box is bad for defenders, but I don't think you end up with the same, for whatever reason, caliber of defenders coming out of the box game as the Americans have.
Yeah.
Growing up in the field game.
I don't know if that has something to do with, you know, the defenders aren't used to playing with their 6-foot stick year round, or, you know, again, if that goes back to the athletes that the U.S. have compared to Canada.
Yeah, so I was a player growing up. I only played with a short stick until midway through my sophomore year of high school, and then switched to long pole and ended up being pretty decent, like within the span of a year or 2 years. So I would argue that it's my theory has not been that it's not so much with the long pole, because I think that comes pretty quick.
Yeah.
If you have the basic lacrosse skills.
Yep.
My thought is it's a combination of the athletes, and also what we talked about with, in the same way that you don't have the X attackman, you don't have those guys who are used to defending from X.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so it inverts, and it's tricky for sort of some people to realize sometimes, is you basically end up top the way that you want to deny the middle of the field and deny people sort of getting topside. From X, denying topside means the opposite, where you're sort of pushing them back to the middle.
Right. Right.
And that is tricky, especially tricky for young players to understand. And that's why inverting, I think, a lot of people invert short sticks, but I think the opposite, a lot of times you can toast like junior high long poles by inverting them up top, where they're used to turning guys back to the middle.
Right.
And so they give it to you, and it's awesome if you realize it and take advantage of it. So those are my two thoughts on it. But no, it is an interesting question. One more specifically though, that you're, as far as I can tell, you're possibly the most qualified, if you look at a combination of box and field goalie abilities, of anybody in the world. that, and we talked about it, mentioned it before with Doug Jamieson, who's a box goalie and faces off for the Iroquois. And you also have the other big example, the opposite way, Blaze Reardon, who's a field goalie and plays offense in box.
Same as Brett Queener.
Right. Frank, can you talk a little bit about what are, I guess that's, I shouldn't ignore Brett Queener. but I just think, you know. With Blaze Reardon playing on the U.S. team,
yeah,
indoors, came to mind.
Yep.
What are the differences and the challenges of going from playing goalie in one to the other?
Well, first off, you know, the Canadian goalie now, Kyle Hebert, is a box goalie as well, so he's in the same kind of boat that I'm in. But you know, the major difference is you know, it's a different game. Like I don't have any equipment on in the field game. I'm holding my stick up by my ear rather than down between my legs. You know, the shots in box, you're seeing 50, 60 shots a game, whereas in field you could see 10 shots in a game, you could see 25 shots in a game. And location, like in box you're getting hammered on from 10 yards and in the field game. You know, you could see shots from 15 yards. You may see a couple shots from inside 7-8 yards, but for the most part, you'll see shots from 8 to 12 yards out. So it's just, you know, it's just a completely different game. But at the same time, I think being a box goalie to a field goalie, I think I was actually talking to Brody Merrill about this last night after our game, about how, you know, he thinks that box goalies may have stronger instincts in the field game in terms of, you know, inside shots, just because we're so used to seeing shots from the inside and, you know, being able to get reads on guys a little bit easier just, because, you know, when you play against guys in box, you, it's very easy to pick up like how people are lining up to shoot, where they're most likely going to shoot kind of thing. And I think that's a big strength in a box goalie crossing over being a field goalie.
Okay, and I guess and vice versa as well. That if you're a field goalie, does that help at all? Do you think?
Yeah, I think it helps me more in terms of like controlling a defense, talking to my defense, and you know, being vocal with them, letting them know, you know, whether I like where I want it, who, you know, because boxers so only so little guys who play. It's very easy to almost pick on guys and be like, all right, if when he has the ball, we want him to shoot kind of thing. So I think that leadership communication crosses over very good, very well from the field game to the box game. And then also outletting the ball, starting to transition going the other way and in box coming from the field game.
Oh yeah. Cause that always looks, that's one thing that it looks so awkward with all the box goalie equipment on, having to throw those passes.
Right. I would say it's a lot easier. It's a lot easier than it looks. I personally find it fairly easy throwing with all that gear on and with the wooden stick.
Oh yeah, it's not necessarily just it looks difficult. It just looks awkward.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
To me, as someone who is coming very much from the field game and doesn't have a whole ton of box exposure,
right.
Kind of concluding one last topic that I wanted to touch on that we kind of got into a little bit on Twitter the other night, well, actually a couple nights. We did it in the U.S. Yeah. Canada game, yeah. and during the U.S. Iroquois game, but the international rules and the pace of play and stalling. Do you have any thoughts on first? Like the first question is, does something need to be done?
It's tough. I don't know if it's a needs to be done or a can be done, just because, you know, lacrosse isn't like, you know, basketball and soccer and these other sports that are already developed. Lacrosse is very much a developing sport, and to throw a shot clock on or, you know, try to pick up the pace of play could be very detrimental to these countries that are just starting up and just learning the game of lacrosse. So I don't know if it's a need more or less than it can't or shouldn't be done in terms of, you know, just the development of the sport.
Yeah, I guess I feel similarly to kind of tear apart the way I phrased the question, but I don't think something needs to be done.
Right.
But I think it's a case where if we can do something that doesn't dramatically impact those countries, make it more difficult where it's developing, we should. It would be a good idea.
Yeah, but at the same point, like, I personally can't think of something off the top of my head that, you know, would be beneficial to that without, you know, almost being gimmicky, like a gimmicky rule. Because, like, in the NCAA, I find the 30-second shot clock on the ref's discretion gimmicky. The ref shouldn't – I don't think the ref should have control. Like, I have all the respect in the world for refs. They have a very hard job, and they shouldn't have to, on top of enforcing the rules, determine the pace of the play. So I almost find that a little gimmicky. So I don't know what the FIL would be able to do that, like I said, wouldn't be a gimmicky rule.
Yeah, I guess to a certain extent, I like it better than the keep it in rule for NCAA purposes.
Right.
But I mean, we discussed this. I think we both are in the actual possession clock camp.
Definitely.
Side of things for NCAA purposes.
100%.
But I think for FIL purposes, any kind of shot clock, I think, is out of the question.
Yeah.
Just because you're trying to create a rule set that works both for the America-Canada gold medal games, but also for kids playing for the first time in Uganda.
Exactly. And do you think Uganda lacrosse would have the resources to even go out and get shot, like have shot clocks on the field for their games?
Well, I mean, I'm sure. So, like, they built that. Bill Belichick built that nice field for them. They would have some, but it just makes, in a sport where the cost of equipment is already a huge burden, it just adds one more hurdle.
Of course.
That's unnecessary. And I think even more so, like, in a case of, like, England.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one more difficult thing to deal with for sort of their, like, you know, club leagues or, you know, whatever league system they have in countries like England or Germany or Israel.
Well, I even think it'd be difficult for every center in Canada to be able to supply a shot clock for the field lacrosse game, to be perfectly honest.
I mean, they could. They do it for box.
They do it for box, but, you know, not every field is capable to have those you know, shot clocks, and whether it's going to be a visible shot clock or if it's, you know, a parent or a volunteer.
Right, I think that's the biggest thing to me, honestly, is the person. In the case of, like, Canada and the U.S., it's not so much the cost of buying the clock. It's you need an extra person to run it who has to know the rules and just complicates things.
Yeah, exactly.
So my proposal would be, the field doesn't have the lines inside the restraining line that run parallel to, like, the wing lines, 10 yards in from the sideline, that make the keep-it-in area smaller. And so my thought would be, that's something that the FIL rules could add to the field, where you're talking about the added cost is just an extra line of paint.
Right. Or even, you know, you look at their flag down rule, you can only take it behind X once.
Right, that'd be another one that you could look at for the stall situation where you only let teams take it behind X once.
One time.
Or you could even, I've thought about, even, is there an area, a smaller area, where you could go back to the, not the keep it in rule, but the get a touch every 10 seconds rule?
Right.
Where if you created an area where you'd have to sort of dodge to the front of the goal and make the offense get a touch in that area every 10 seconds.
Of course.
That is would be a potential option that would sort of make you attack the goal and give the defense, you wouldn't have to take the ball away. You just have to keep them out of an area in front of the goal.
Yeah.
That would be doable.
I could see, yeah, something like that, but, you know, at the same time, like I said, like, you want to make a rule that wouldn't appear kind of gimmicky.
No, that's fair. I just think of it. It doesn't appear gimmicky to me,
right?
Because I grew up playing with that rule. You had to get a touch in the box every 10 seconds rule.
Yep.
And if you go back and watch, like, some of those old games, it creates people doing what now look like weird things, like where if you're going to go to, like, a 1-4-1 and dodge from up top, you have to send the midfielder up there, and somebody gets a touch in the box right before you pass it to them.
Right.
Which, you know, seems really awkward and unnecessary to do, but that's what you had to do when you had to get a touch every 10 seconds to give that guy time to get back into the box.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, and then, you know, as a defense, you can also press out a lot. You have a little bit more freedom.
No, that's true, because, I mean, it gives you, and it also, one thing I like to do back in that rule is you could tell when the guys were just coming in to try to just get a touch, and so that gave you the ability to time up a check.
Right.
Because they were going to stop there and go back out, so you could, it gave you every 10 seconds a good takeaway opportunity.
Right.
To get the ball back. But no, I'm glad we're in kind of an agreement on that, and I think people who want to go, that think the FIL needs to go to a shot clock, don't appreciate the other issues that would create for developing the game around the world.
Of course.
And I think, unless you have anything else that you wanted to mention or talk about, I think this is going to be wrap things up.
Yeah, I think we hit on just about everything that I was looking forward to hit on.
Okay. Well, then, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for being here. I thought you had a lot of great insight into things.
I appreciate that.
And good luck to your Canadian boys in the semifinals. But not wish them good luck in the championship game.
Well, I won't hold that against you, but I appreciate the good luck in the semifinals.
Sounds good. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh, actually, do you want to plug anything? Twitter, Instagram. Where can people follow you for more?
At DillWard37 is my Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, make sure to give him a follow. And tune in to the championship and the semifinal games tomorrow. And when's the championship? Is it Saturday?
It's got to be Saturday.
There's a day. They give him a day off, I think.
Yeah.
Tune in to the championship game on Saturday to watch. Thanks for listening, guys.